You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Oh, way back when, I once asked the legendary New York newspaper man, Jimmy Breslin, what it was that made New York City the great city that it is. Was it the World Trade Center, the stock market, the garment industry, believe it, that one time employed 250,000 people in New York City? No, he said, what made New York so great is its subway system. A system that allows New Yorkers to go, they can go to work in one place, live in another, they can get from A to B cheaply and easily. And if you've ever been to New York City, you know how true that is. Over 5 million riders pass through those turnstiles every weekday. But even while riding in these underground tunnels, it's easy to take them for granted. It's easy to forget the engineering challenges behind the creation. All those tunnels that had to be carved out of the Manhattan schist, the bedrock of Manhattan Island, concrete that had to be poured for the platforms that had to lay the track, each individual tile. There are some gorgeous tiles on New York City subways. If you're in the city subways, look at those tiles. They're magnificent. Each one of them, one by one, had to be cemented into place, and all of this to create one of New York City's truly distinctive landmarks, the subway. And it's been wowing people for a while now. Back in 1905, there was a tour guide in 1905. The Rand McNally tour guide told people who wanted to visit New York, the tourist will be well repaid by a trip through the borough of this greatest of all underground railways. How did they make it? How did they make the subway system? For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the engineering behind this massive train network, how they tunneled through the island 100 years ago, sometimes with fatal consequences, and how they are still drilling today. They're excavating, as we speak, a few blocks from here, a huge cavern right under Grand Central Station. How do they do that all without damaging the foundation of the busy city above? How do they do it without cutting electric cables, water mains, sewer pipes? How do they keep, you know, a city is surrounded by water, have rivers, it's an island, Manhattan is an island, how do they keep all that water out? Well, if you'd like to ask, our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry and talk about the subway systems. I'd like to introduce my guest. Clifton Hood is the author of 722 Miles, The Building of the Subways and How They Transformed New York, a professor of history at the Hobart and William Smith College in Geneva, New York. He joins us from Cornell University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, you're welcome. My next, also with me here in New York, is Michael Harodinian. I'm going to get your name wrong. Harodnicianu. Did I get that right?
Yes,
Michael Harodnicianu is president of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority's Capital Construction Company here in New York in our studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Let me ask you first, what does MTA Capital Construction do? What's their job?
The MTA Capital Construction Company was formed specifically to carry out the mega projects in New York, and these are the projects that involve the construction of the expansion of the subway system in somewhere over 70 years. We are basically charged to build the extension of number 7 to the west side of Manhattan.
The 7 train.
That's correct. The Second Avenue subway, that phase 1, that will go from 96th to 63rd Street. The east side access, that is bringing the Long Island Railroad trains into Manhattan on the east side under the Grand Central. We are about 140 feet below the surface there, as well as the Fulton Transit Center, that there is in lower Manhattan, the intercept of 11 of the 22 subway lines, and in addition to that, we have the PATH there. So it's an incredible
interchange. A lot of work. Tell us the ABCs of building a subway tunnel. I mean, how does the actual blasting, grinding go? How does it go on?
I was going to say the first thing, we need money.
You are certainly a New Yorker. I mean, let me ask Clifton Hood. In the old days, they blasted it out with dynamite?
No.
Well, I think Michael's answer that they need money is the best one. But that's always been true. But the original subways were really built by hand. Mm-hmm. They used dynamite, but there were people using picks and shovels. They had almost no mechanized equipment like we would think of today, bulldozers. It was remarkably labor-intensive. And I think that's probably the biggest change to today.
Michael, you agree?
Well, partially. The subways of the past were primarily what we will call today cut and cover. Mm-hmm. That means we cut a channel into the street, mm-hmm. and then we end up building the walls. And it's irrelevant for the moment how we what was done. It was done by hand, and the material used was concrete, was cast iron, and whatever way it was done. But it was done by cutting channels into the street. I have in the lobby of my office pictures of the building of the IRT along Broadway, in which there are two huge channels to the left and right where the roadways are today, with total disregard of what happened to pedestrian traffic, to people living in adjacent buildings or anything. That thing is a thing of the past. What we have today is... the biggest difference is that, number one, we have to build in a much denser urban setting, mm-hmm. in which we upset many more people than before, people that now look at the environmental impacts that were in at the beginning of the 20th century were really people. They existed, but people did not know what they were called, so therefore they didn't complain. And today we have the biggest difference is we have what is known as a tunnel boring machine. That means we can actually bore tunnels at a much a greater depth than before in a mechanical fashion. That means we can advance much faster than we would have done it in the past when we actually needed to shoot and blast. That means we put dynamite blasted it, hold it out, and then repeated that over and over again.
So this machine is like, I've seen pictures of it, it's like a giant disc that rotates and cuts through the rock?
Right. The front of the machine is a 200-ton disc, mm-hmm. that cuts through the rock. Now, there are various types of machines, but to make it simple, the one that has been used primarily now in rock has lateral grips. Think of it as some shoes that press against, like a brake that mm-hmm. press against the sides of the tunnel. That keeps the machine in place. And beyond that, the machine, by rotating, cutting, and crumbling the rock, is advancing. Now, only the head of the machine advances up to about 6 feet, and then the rest of the machine, the gear that is up to 850 feet long, will follow through.
Wow.
So think of it as an inchworm. And the cabin that actually the machine is controlled from, or the electronics and in which we really keep the alignment. Remember, we have to go in a certain direction, a certain slope, left, right, whatever right. that is. Think of it as the Jules Verne books in which...
Right, I've seen that picture.
Right.
Yes, a giant screw pulling us
right.
out.
Right. So that's what we're doing, in effect.
Clifton Hood, now, when they first started building the subways, did they know what was down there that they were digging into?
No, they actually didn't. Skyscrapers were just getting underway. William Barclay Parsons, who's the chief engineer of the first IRT tunnel, put a lot of test bores down underground and was really surprised to discover that the level of bedrock varied so much over the course of Manhattan. It's very close to the surface around Wall Street. It dips in Greenwich Village and Chelsea, and then it comes up closer to the surface around what we now call Midtown. This just wasn't known, and the engineers like Parsons had to come up with a way of dealing with it. And this also directly affected where they put the tunnel. Were they going to put it really deep underground? They decided not to do that because they were afraid that people wouldn't go down and use the subway, and they were worried about escalators, elevators,
right.
Ventilation. Were they going to put it at a medium depth? They decided not to do that because they would have had to cross what engineers called a mixed face. And so they decided to put it very close to the surface.
And that's why you see skyscrapers are not evenly spaced on Manhattan. They're where the bedrock is closer to the surface, like the
I think
Midtown
that's part
of it. And downtown.
I think that's part of it. But another reason is that downtown just is where New York City started.
Right.
And Midtown is where the two great railroad terminals are, Grand Central and Pennsylvania Railroad. And I think that precipitated changes in those areas, too. So in a way, we really got lucky.
Let me ask you, Michael, with all these skyscrapers above when you're digging these tunnels below,
right.
How do you keep them from not, you know, they're so plumb and whatever, and they're sitting on from vibrating and just twisting about enough that they might collapse underneath?
I have to tell you that actually the biggest challenge are not the skyscrapers, are the utilities.
And the water and the electricity.
And I want to read you just actually.
You'll get back to answering that question, but
I want to read you something so you'll understand. And this is actually taken out of a magazine. The present interruption to traffic, the interminable and absolutely stupid way in which our choicest streets are dug up, relayed, and dug up again in a perpetual and obtrusive nuisance, which would not be tolerated in any provincial town and cannot be too soon removed from the streets of one of the greatest cities in the world. This is the story of our utilities, mm-hmm. okay, that you see all the cuts in the streets. By the way, this is an article in the Scientific American, May 25th, 1901.
Yeah.
Okay?
You could have written that today is what you said.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is important to understand what we're doing because a lot of the work that is so complex today, particularly in certain parts of the system, at least in our work that we have done, that we have to have startup pits where we drop the tunnel boring machine and so forth, that we do cut and cover, and we have to move all the utilities around. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue. But to answer your question, the skyscrapers are really well designed, okay, and many of them have a foundation on rock. And at a level and at a location that we are actually boring, mm-hmm. We are not disturbing them. Yet we have what I refer to as the fragile buildings, and along Second Avenue, I have identified about 225 of them in the area that we're working. These were buildings that were put together built at the end of the 19th century, somewhere 1860s to 1890s, on a rubble foundation. And every time we go by, they vibrate. We are very careful to make sure. We're very careful to make sure that nothing happens. Our biggest tunnel, the one that we're doing for the East Side Access, is 140 feet below ground. Quite frankly, no one knows we exist. It's a stealth project. Mm-hmm. We are going there, and we continue to go, similar to the third water tunnel that was just like that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about subway construction this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Clifton Hood, how did they tunnel under rivers back in the old days? I mean, there are a lot of tunnels under the East River, subways, things like that.
They started building tunnels under the East River and the Hudson River in the 1880s, but the technology wasn't really good enough. Both what we call the Steinway Tunnel and what's now the Path Tunnel came to an end. They went bankrupt. They had problems with accidents. But the real difference was made in the 1890s when a British engineer named Greathead devised a better shield. Maybe the grandfather to the bore that Michael was talking about, though a lot different. But this provided covering for workers. This allowed them to bore ahead, and they were able to make progress. And both the Hudson and Manhattan, now the PATH train, and the Steinway Tunnel were completed in the first decade of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So this was a protection device for the workers.
It was part a protection device and partly a cutting device, too. Uh-huh. But it was still dangerous.
Did they have trouble convincing people to go in a subway that was going to go under the water?
They did.
When I was a kid going through all the tunnels and the cars in New York and the subways, I was always wondering, where's that leak going to come from? Right.
Well, you refer to Manhattan as being an island. We don't think of it that way because of all the bridges and tunnels. But it was an island city, and a lot of people worried about going underground, especially when they heard about accidents in this construction. Mm-hmm. And they were worried that the trains would get stopped. They'd be worried that the water would come in, and this happens sometimes during construction. So, yeah, people were worried.
Mm-hmm. Were there fatalities in this?
Well,
must have been
construction? Yeah. Well, I think the interesting story there is that one of the real problems in building the subway tunnels was that the workers would get the bends. And they used to wear labels, badges on their jackets that would say, if found unconscious, bring me to the hospital at gate Q. But the really striking thing was that a disproportionate number of African Americans were hired as the laborers to build these tunnels, because a story got told that they were somehow immune to the bends. That's total nonsense, but that is what some people wanted to believe. And so you see racism making its way in the construction of the subway. They weren't hired in disproportionate numbers in other parts of the subway construction.
Why would they get the bends? What, you know, that's like from pressurized air down there?
Yeah.
Right. To keep the water out? Michael?
Yeah.
The same.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
In general, if you really drill to rock, you did not need a pressurized environment. But the moment you had either water penetration or you're on soft ground, you needed to work in a pressurized environment. The pressurized environment normally implied that you're going to be at somewhere around 2 to 3 bars. Just so you understand, 1 bar is the equivalent, if we want to look at in a different way. If you are going to go down into the water, right, and you're going to scuba dive,
right,
30 feet is acceptable. That's about 1 bar.
1 atmosphere.
That's right. So you're not going to suffer if you come up with, you know, it's fine.
Right.
Once you go above that, you create, if you move then fast up, the nitrogen in the blood tends to bubble and goes into your joints and so forth. So you need a decompression time that potentially the people, when they did that, and the Brooklyn Bridge is a good example of the foundation, they did not know what created that. So that's...
They got the bends.
That's correct.
Larry, we're going to take a break and come back and talk more with Michael Horacinianu and Clifton Hood, author of 722 Miles, The Building of the Subways and How They Transformed New York. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. And you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. What is there you'd like to know about building subways that you don't already know or we haven't talked about? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday. We're talking this hour about building a subway, digging all those tunnels out, especially here in New York, with my guest Michael Horacinianu, who is president of Metropolitan Transportation Authority. We call it the MTA here, the Capital Construction Company here in New York. Clifton Hood, author of 722 Miles, The Building of the Subways and How They Transform New York. Lots of phone calls today. Let's see how many we can get in. And let's go to the phone. Let's go to Paul in Smithtown, New York. Hi, Paul.
Hey, great show. Love it.
Thank you.
What happens, I understand how the machine basically bores and is guided. What do they do with the waste, and how does that machine get rid of it?
All right. Michael, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, absolutely. We have we are carrying it from the machine outside, and depends on the project, sometimes a few miles from the location on a conveyor belt, and then it goes into one specific location, and from there is hauled, is tracked away. This material, it depending on, and if we talk about the tunnel boring machine in rock, it is really dust that it goes out because it's being crumbled. The mica schist that we have, the Manhattan schist is really made out of mica, and it looks dusty, and if you put water, it actually gets muddy and is being just carried away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just goes to the end of the machine, that 850 feet, and it gets loaded into...
But where do they dump it when they get...
Oh, it goes... I mean, some of it, for example, is right now part of the Brooklyn Bridge Park.
Landfill.
Yeah, we put it there. Yeah. You know, that's... And most of it is going away, and quite frankly, there are people that would like to know, including myself, exactly where they end up. I'm not sure.
Some future civilization. Thanks for calling, Paul.
Thank you for the answer. I was just trying to figure it out, and I love machines.
Yeah, we all do. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
In fact, when they built the World Trade Center, they had all that stuff to dig up.
It's called today Battery Park.
Battery Park.
Yeah.
Did they have those problems back then, Clifton, what to do?
They did. They put a lot of the landfill around Governor's Island, around Lower Manhattan. Same thing.
Okay, let's see. A lot of people have interesting questions. Let's go to Allison in Orlando. Hi, Allison.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering how you actually get the boring machine into place in such a densely populated area. It's not like the side of a mountain where it's open. How do you physically get it into place?
Into a tight little spot there.
Right. Normally, like we, as an example, we did for number 7 and 2nd Avenue, we created a launching pad underground. It's a real launching box that is about on 2nd Avenue, 80 feet down, about 70 feet wide, and we have an opening on the roadway, and we lower that piece by piece, and then is assembled down into the pit, and it's being activated. It's a very complex thing, and then we start moving into position to into what we refer to as the starter tunnel, and we start boring. As we're advancing, we are adding pieces to it. They move on a rail, by the way, that is being laid down. And as we advance, the rail is being actually added to it. And these machines normally end up very long, like 850 feet. At the end of the run, we disassemble it and we pull it back. And the head cutter that is 200 tons is being taken apart into pieces and then hauled out and then just out of the launching box. But at the same time, sometimes we take the head of the machine and we leave it in place for the future generation to fund it.
So that 1,000 years from now when they dig up,
they'll
see.
200 years, they will find something. So what was
the
that?
Heck?
It might take that long to get money to extend the lines, too.
That's right. It'll finish the 2nd Avenue if it ever gets done. Clifton, how do they decide on electric trains? I mean, we're now in an era of where electricity is magic, so to speak, at that point 125, 30 years ago, right?
No, that wasn't the case at all. In the 19th century, there's a real search for a motive power. The first subway in the world is in London in 1863, and they use, of all things, steam power. The trains there ran in open cuts, and yet they still vomited out this smoke and cinders and exhaust. When the New York subway was being developed in the 1890s, electric power was just about 5 or 6 years old. And so the chief engineer goes over to London. He goes to the very first electric power subway in the world, the city in South London. He sees that it works. They come back and they decide to go with it. It's a bit of a gamble. Most mass transit innovations take place not in big cities like Tokyo or New York City, but rather in smaller places. The first feasible electric railway is in Richmond, Virginia. And the reason for that is that if something goes wrong in New York City, it is a disaster. You've got tens of thousands of people who can't get to work.
Hmm. Well, where is the that's interesting. Where is the invention of the subway sandwich? Why is that related to the New York City subways? It's called something. It's something else in every other city. Why?
Yeah, it really is. I've always guessed it must be the shape, but I do know that if used to be at least that you would go into subway shops and, well, I would be doing research in Lower Manhattan, and I would come out for lunch, and I'd go into a subway shop, and I would look at my research scattered across the walls because they had this wallpaper that showed the original kiosks.
That was my next question. Is that the real stuff? Is that really the real stuff?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. There was a New York Times or there was a New York City paper from October 27th, 1904. That's the day the very first subway opened. And that's what I'm saying. That's literally my research and making its way to wallpaper. And I know the subway restaurants start in Connecticut, but somebody must have... Oh, it must have been one of your callers. They must be in love with it, just like I think so many people are.
1-800-989-8255. That answered the question. I've always wondered about the subway sandwich shops. Laura in Victor, New York. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good to speak with you. Great show.
Thank you.
Even though I live in Victor, New York, which is near Rochester, I was born and raised in the Bronx, and some of my earliest memories are of the subway from the 50s. I used to think that the subways were singing a song because of the rhythm of the subways. We traveled on the subway a lot. I was a very, very little girl. And I would get kind of irritated when no one else could hear the songs that the subways were singing. But I also wanted to share an incredible novel about the building of the subways called This Side of Brightness by Colin McCann. And it follows a group of Sandhogs and then subsequent generations. And it's about both the subways in a historical context and also in a kind of psychological and mythical context. And it's absolutely beautiful. And for anyone who has a relationship with the subways, it's really an incredible experience to read that book. So I thank you for your wonderful program.
Well, thank you for that recommendation, and have a good weekend. Clifton, have you heard of that book?
Yeah, I think that the thing is that you really do need novels. There are very few records left of the workers who built the subways in the, well, from 1900 to about 1940. Their stories really have been lost.
Michael, let me ask you about a project that you're working on where I've heard that you have to freeze the ground
right
before you dig it.
In a number of locations we're doing it.
Tell us about one.
Here is the thing. As you know, and I think that has been mentioned before, that the geotechnical makeup of Manhattan is really kind of spotty, so to speak. We found out that 2nd Avenue, on the west side of 2nd Avenue, the rock is relatively okay. But it precipitously falls towards the East River. So there is a location, there is a spot, there is a stretch and around 92nd, 91st Street where the ground, the rock is totally fragmented. We have lots of water. Mm-hmm. And there is a fear is that if we go there and we go with a TBM, we will not be able to go through without the potential collapse. So what we have done is to introduce long pipes that go down about 90 feet or so. These are then filled up with brine. We have a couple of refrigeration units outside, and we're literally freezing the ground. It takes about 10 to 12 weeks to do that. Once it's done, we are going to go in with a TBM. We're going to cut. TBM is a tunnel boring machine.
Right.
We're going to cut through the pipes, by the way.
Leave them there.
Oh, yeah. We're cutting through that, right?
Right.
And then, obviously, we're going to immediately close the area to make sure it is well supported. And then we're going to defrost the ground in a very careful, orchestrated way so we will not affect the buildings around it that. When you freeze ground, the freeze and thaw cycles tend to actually move the ground up and down, and this is something that you do not want to do to the building surrounding it.
Yeah.
We have done that on 11th Avenue, for the number 7, on a stretch of about 400 feet. We are doing it on a major thing. We are doing a very short tunnel, 120 feet under the Northern Boulevard that carries two subway lines, one on top of other. And we have to do that while supporting the subway. So again, we're now doing horizontal freeze.
Wow. Here's a question, a tweet that came in from St. Louis, who asked, Sci-Fry SL says, how do you tell where you are in a tunnel? I mean, says GPS won't work down there. You don't have the sun, the moon, whatever, to take bearings. How do you know exactly where you are in the tunnel?
Remember I told you about the cabin? Well, first of all,
And you have to meet another tunnel sometimes, right?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Serving equipment has been around for many years, and we did not have GPS. When I went to school, I learned how to survey and put location without having to have GPS.
Right.
Okay, people navigated boats and airplanes using the stars sometimes.
But that's what they're saying, though. Underground, you don't have the stars.
You don't have the stars, but it's a much smaller environment. You know exactly where you are in terms of – because you can survey it. So you would know vis-a-vis the point that you start behind you, okay, where you're going to be in terms of elevation and in terms of lateral movement. So that's actually not such a complex thing.
There you go.
And we're doing it. I really wanted to, as I know you.
Let me just remind everybody, this is Science Friday from NPR. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I really remember I read you something from 1901, And there was a purpose into that, because I think that if we talk about building subways, there is in 1901, people decided that in order to make proper provision for the large number of electric cables and gas and water pipes and sewers which lie beneath the streets of the city, they were going to create a gallery alongside of the tunnel, the rapid transit subway, to place these utilities. So one would never have to dig again.
Makes sense to
right?
me.
Right, right.
Look how well that's worked out.
So the point is that then this was just moved aside because there was a certain cost associated right. with that. We could have amortized that cost 1,000 times over. And in fact, right. we
all
have failed
digging.
To create oh. that going forward as well.
Absolutely.
So
all
we keep
digging.
Cutting our streets.
Let me ask you, Clifton Hood, in a few minutes we have left, was it a big hit when it first opened? Did the people readily get on it and travel on it?
The very first day the subway opened, the paper's headline is "The Birth of the Subway Crush."
Wow. Right from day one.
Think, yeah, and the planned maximum capacity for the subway was exceeded within 2 or 3 years. Nobody had any idea how popular it would be. And the real thing that was different is that New York has express and local service, and only the Broad Street line in Philadelphia has that. And that is what enabled the subway to have the impact it did in changing the physical landscape. Manhattan was really only developed to about the Upper West Side, the Upper East Side, and it unleashes this massive construction boom. But also, there are so many more people taking the subway, and they can ride it so much longer. The other thing that's really striking is that in doing the research for this book, I discovered that there are all sorts of love songs that were written about the subway in the first 5 or 6 years. This is Tin Pan Alley. And there was a song about a boy and a girl meeting in Lower Manhattan, being pushed into each other's arms and falling in love by Harlem. That thing used to be 15 minutes to Harlem. And so it really was a phenomenon. And we think of it as being outdated today, but for 1904, for 1910, well before airplanes, this was really technologically modern. And so it was a big deal in that way, too. People would go down in it just for sightseeing, to see something.
Do you think people really think the subways are outdated? Here in New York, I don't think people, you know, it's still, people depend on it. Jimmy Breslin was right 20 years ago when I asked him that
Oh,
question.
He was. Yeah. He was. But I don't think we conceive of it as being, it's not that the subways are outdated, but I think that the operating equipment isn't viewed as being, you know, we think of computers now. We think of mm-hmm. the internet as being the latest thing.
Right.
In 1900, the subway was the latest thing.
Mm-hmm. And they're going to be modernized. Michael,
yeah.
is there any way to upgrade them to 21st century?
Well, we are trying to build the stations to be the 21st century, and I think the trains and the automatic train control will show up. And there is clearly a push to more automation, to technology advances on the subway system. So the new cars are actually being built with much more technology advanced systems, and that's going to be the trend throughout the 21st century. But we are trying to build our stations to match the 21st century technology.
Well, and one of the great changes the last 5 or 10 years has been that you can be in a subway station and there will be a sign telling you that the next train will be 5 or 10 minutes away.
Right.
And that's just a remarkable convenience for passengers.
All right. And we've run out of time. I want to thank Michael Horodnicianu, who is president of the MTA Capital Construction Company. Clifton Hood, author of 722 Miles, The Building of the Subways and How They Transformed New York. Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very, very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Kim Ileski and Sam Flato, our intern, working the phones here today in New York. Missed any part of our program, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, download our podcast, our audio and video. You can also take us along on your iPhone and download our iPhone app for instant access to Science Friday.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
And also, you go to our website and take the survey we have going on there, and we'd like to hear what you think about Science Friday. We'd like to hear from you any way that you can, so Be current and stay with us and talk to us at Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.